Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, part one of a conversation with Ed Brubaker. Ed, of course, is out promoting his brand new book from Icon called Criminal, with his old pal from Sleeper, Sean Phillips, handling art chores. For years, Brubaker has shown his love for crime comics by producing some of the genre's best modern stories in collected works like Scene of the Crime with artist Michael Lark, Sleeper, his first series with Sean Phillips, and collaborating with pals Lark and writer Greg Rucka on the police procedural Gotham Central. Brubaker had great runs on Batman and Detective Comics, plus a redefining character run on Catwoman. These days, Brubaker works at Marvel Comics, where he guides the fates of the X-Men, Captain America, and Daredevil, not to mention the popular miniseries The Book of Doom. Part of his new deal with Marvel came the option to start a new creator-owned series with the Icon imprint. The result? His team up with old partner Sean Phillips on the neo-noir series Criminal.
Let's talk about Criminal. I'm really excited about it because I was a huge Sleeper fan.
Well, thank you.
And really enjoyed yours and Sean's work, and especially Sean's art, which I always felt had a kinship to the paperback covers of things like Mac Bolan, The Executioner, and all those cool male adventure books of the 60s and 70s.
Real Robert McGinnis kind of feel to the way Sean's covers are painted and stuff like that. When he was out here visiting, we spent like an afternoon on the internet, like just looking at old Bob McGinnis cover paintings, and you know, because like, he's obviously an influence on Sean to begin with, but I really wanted, especially, you know, the first few Criminal covers. I think I might have pushed him a little too far on the first one to try to, like, ape that McGinnis style, which he said he couldn't really do. But I think he did a great job, and the next two covers look even better, actually. I just got the cover for issue 3 this morning, and it instantly became my... I had just decided the other day I wasn't going to do backgrounds for my computer screen anymore because I had my computer guy over, and he told me that they actually use a fair amount of memory. So I decided I wasn't going to do that anymore, and then I got this cover, and it immediately became my screen background. I was like, oh my God, this is the best one yet. It gets better and better. It's really scary.
And it sounds like the entire package, before we talk about the specific stories, that this is really going to be a crime magazine, almost in the same way that the old Marvel black and white Deadly Hands of Kung Fu was like a martial arts magazine.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like it to be more like that than it ended up being for the first issue, at least. Yeah, I want to have, we're going to have articles and stuff. In fact, Patton Oswalt is writing some movie reviews for me on these rare noir films that aren't available on DVD at all. That he lives in L.A., so they have, like, you know, these old theaters that'll show, like, a film that hasn't been shown for 25 years.
Cool.
So he's like, sort of a noir expert, and he's agreed to do some movie reviews for me, and I've got, you know, other people I'm lining up to do stuff like that with too.
You know, I'm a huge noir fan as well, and I interviewed Azzarello a couple years ago, and he was telling me about films like Rififi and some really cool foreign films. What are some hidden gems of yours that you would recommend to people?
You know, I don't know how hidden my gems are. My favorite noir film of all time, or my favorite movie probably of all time, is Out of the Past, which is Robert Mitchum. I think that's one of the best movies ever made. But I'm also a big fan of you know, that sort of late 60s, early 70s, like, you know, modern faux noir, you know, like the Get Carter, Point Blank,
yep,
like stuff like that. That's sort of what I refer to as I think of it as a genre, sort of the revenge noir.
Okay.
You know, like Get Carter and Point Blank and The Limey. Probably my, after Out of the Past, I'm crouching in front of my noir shelf right now. You know, I'm a big fan of The Naked Kiss, the Sam Fuller movie.
Cool.
I think that's one of the best, you know, crime films, just because it's such a creepy movie about, like, a prostitute who moves to a small town and tries to change her life and becomes a nurse, and everywhere she goes, she can't escape her past, you know, and then she thinks she finally has by falling in love with the richest man in town who turns out to be, like, a sex perv. and wants to have sex with children, and Lynn likes her because she thinks that he, you know, he thinks that she'll understand him. And I always just thought that was so twisted. I think The Killing is Stanley Kubrick's best movie, and I'll stand by that.
Great movie, absolutely.
My uncle was a screenwriter back in the 40s, too, and wrote, like, a couple of classic noir films. He wrote Murder, My Sweet and Crossfire.
Wow.
Which are, yeah, both just amazing movies. And in fact, Murder, My Sweet was Chandler's favorite adaptation of his own stuff, and he preferred the guy who played Philip Marlowe even to Humphrey Bogart. He liked Bogart as a guy, but he thought that
Dick Powell.
he thought that his Philip Marlowe didn't come across the way he intended as a Dick Powell, because Dick Powell had this background as like a singer and a dancer.
Yes.
He hopped around more and was just more of that kind of character. But yeah, I just, you know, I watched just a ton of crime stuff in general, and you know, I can't, off the top of my head, I can't draw out too many for some reason right now.
Well, those are some good ones. And Dick Powell.
I'm a big fan of Gun Crazy, the original Gun Crazy too, which I think was, it looks like it was made for about $5. It has like the best falling in love moment in any movie ever, where they shoot matches lit on each other's heads. Have you ever seen that one?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, I love that scene at the carnival when he falls in love with the sharpshooter, and they each wear that crown of matches, and they shoot bullets at each other's faces, and that's how they fall in love, by, like, lighting fire around each other's head with bullets.
That's outstanding, man.
I know. I was just like, okay, this is twisted.
It was funny, when you guys did Sleeper, I always thought of Holden being, it was Holden, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm blanking for a second, but I always thought of him more as Lee Marvin, and it was cool that you're like, no, you kind of envisioned him more as Steve McQueen.
Yeah, he was Steve McQueen with a little bit of Marlon Brando thrown in, was how I told Sean to draw him, basically. But yeah, I was, you know, it's funny because, you know, Lee Marvin, who doesn't love Lee Marvin? But,
you bet.
But at the same time, I really did want to, you know, I'm a Steve McQueen man.
Nothing wrong with that, man, great films.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Steve McQueen, apparently one of the world's largest assholes, but
yeah, he was quite a thug.
Was he?
Well, you know, yeah, that's what I heard, that like he was kind of a badass in like when he would be on shoots. I heard that he loaded a shotgun with rock salt and was just blasting it to drive people crazy
on one
of his shoots.
Yeah, I just was watching the making of for the Magnificent Seven, and they talked about the ego clashes between him and Yul Brynner, and how like it was like this. You know, it was a big deal. You were either on one of their gang or the other one, and it was like, you know, like dueling entourages or something. It just sounded really funny.
Not to mention stealing Robert Evans' kid and Ally McGraw on the getaway.
Yeah, stole, yeah.
Pretty harsh.
Yeah. Oh, that's one of my favorite noirs, actually.
You bet.
Is the, you know, that Jim Thompson adaptation, the Getaway to McQueen one. I just think that's a brilliant fucking movie.
Absolutely. So now you went from Sleeper, which was really tied to the Wildstorm universe, but also like this international organization, to what seems to be with Criminal, from what it sounds like, street level crime. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it's street level crime. It's. I mean, the difference to me isn't as drastic, because I always saw Sleeper as a character study set around the sort of world of like international espionage and superheroes, and I always saw it as more of a character study. So, with me, Criminal is not that different from that. It's still about like people, you know, put into places where they think they're going in for one thing, and then something, you know, something changes for that, because, you know, with any good crime story, nothing ever goes the way it's planned.
Yep.
You know, I mean, if it goes as planned, you got a 20-minute long story.
That's,
you know,
true.
I mean, that's why Reservoir Dogs was such a work of genius, like when it came out, I think, but just purely on a level of dialogue and structure, it was the most brilliant crime story, because it didn't have the crime. Everything else, it was like, wow, that's fucking like somebody took like French New Wave and mixed it with like, you know, 70s like Peckinpah crime story kind of look, and you know, and that just blew me away at the time, because I just thought, how great to not even show the crime, and it's like, what a great way to make a low budget crime thriller.
And isn't it great how crime has changed from, you know, the Hammett and Chandler era,
to
going overseas in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and seeing what the French and the Italians did with it, and then to come back and build on that.
Yeah, totally. I have this real fascination for you know, all elements of the genre, but I've never, until now, I don't think I've ever completely written something from the criminal's point of view, other than like Sleeper, where I was using that sort of, you know, that old video game Driver, which sort of predated Grand Theft Auto,
where you were
a wheelman for the mob,
uh-huh.
but you were secretly an undercover cop, because they couldn't just do a story where you were, at that time they weren't sure you could just sell a game about the bad guys, you know, and so they had that conceit of, well, you're a good guy pretending to be a bad guy, and that was sort of the same idea behind Sleeper, was that, you know, it was a good guy pretending to be a bad guy who gets stuck, you know, it was like that sort of Mother Night kind of thing, the Vonnegut book about the guy who pretends to be a Nazi sympathizer and his life is destroyed after that, you know, because no one can ever know that he was, that he wasn't actually who he pretended to be. And I always liked that idea. But that was a lot about what, you know, for me, that was the whole conceit of Sleeper, is like, who are you really? You know, like, are you the people, are you, you know, because you just, you know, if you're at all self-conscious, you realize that you change around different people. Like, the way you are when you talk to me is probably not the same way you are when you talk to your best friend. You know, it's just how people are. People are a little bit different around different people, and that's just life.
Well, that's fair.
And, you know, but I always have been fascinated by that. Like, which one is the real person then? You know, and so that was kind of what Sleeper was about to me, you know, at the heart of all of it. But it was about a lot of stuff, too. But with Criminal, what Sean and I have been able to do, and part of it is because I think when I first came up with the initial idea for the first story that we're doing in Criminal was probably like 4 years ago. And so I've been having the story and the characters in it and the whole like world that they exist in developing in my head for 4 years now, to the point where when I sat down to write the first script, I felt like I'd already written it in a way. And it was interesting. I had to challenge myself to do stuff differently than the way I had always been envisioning it, to make it, you know, more interesting. And then a bunch of new ideas appeared to me, but I felt like I had the safety net of knowing where the story was going and how it worked out, and, you know, knowing the elements of this world that these people live in. And it really does feel more like that. It's almost like, you know how, like, a good comic strip, like Peanuts or like, you know, Gilbert Hernandez's stuff in Love and Rockets, like, you feel like they create a world
Yes. That
their characters all exist
Certainly.
In, or Pogo, or even Archie. There's, like, a world that these characters all exist in, sort of like the Marvel Universe or the DC Universe. They exist in a world. I'm thinking in terms of more of, like, a self-contained one, like the Archie books. You know, there's 5 books, and there's no continuity, but they've got their world.
Absolutely. Riverdale is a recognizable environment.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Brian Azzarello could do, like, a short story that took place in the world of 100 Bullets that wasn't necessarily about any of his characters. I mean, he does all the time.
Yep.
Like, 100 Bullets is a universe in a way. And for Criminal, we have the same kind of thing, where, like, there's a bunch of different characters that are in the book, and you'll hear, like, an allusion to a character issues before you actually ever meet the character themselves. Actually, the main character for the second storyline, you don't meet until the 6th issue, but by the time you meet him, if you've read the book closely enough and you've read the backup stories and stuff, you've got a fairly good idea of who he is already by the time you meet him. And you know, like, stuff that's happened to his father and his brother, and you know little bits and pieces of this guy, but you don't know, you know, but it's not until you meet him that you get, like, the pieces will come together. And
okay.
So there's little things like that that, you know, that I just feel like it make it different than anything else that I've ever done, really.
Well, you're building anticipation for that kind of character.
Yeah, exactly. And also just, it doesn't feel like I'm doing just, you know, a crime story. It feels like I'm building a world. And in the same way, partially I was inspired by Elmore Leonard's stuff.
Even sure.
I'm not the hugest Elmore Leonard fan in the world, but I've read a number of his books, and I think he's a really good writer. But what I liked was that his characters would move from one book to the next, but, like, you know, a character who was the main character in one book would just appear in a few scenes in another book. And
sure.
I always thought that was so cool, because then you knew that it was like the Elmore Leonard verse, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was one of the things I really wanted to do with Criminal, was to create this sort of umbrella universe where all the different kinds of crime stories that I wanted to write ever could take place in. And with each, like, scene that I write, like, little doors open that sort of go, oh, and this thing can be this. And, you know, it's like, it's really been, it's kind of addictive, actually. Like, all these little pieces, it's like a puzzle sort of forming before me. And, you know, it also gives me a chance to tap into the sort of, you know, the other side of my crime reading, which has been the, you know, like, the first crime stuff I ever read, long before I ever read any mysteries, was, like, Jim Thompson and James M. Cain.
Sure.
And David Goodis, and these guys who all wrote from the criminal's point of view, or from the point of view of the guy accused of a crime who's, like, on the run. Like,
yep.
The stuff the noirs were all based on, really.
You bet.
You know, like, The Killer Inside Me kind of, you know, stuff. And I've never really written that sort of a story, but, you know, I've read tons of them. You know, I've read, like, a bunch of the Parker novels that Donald Wesley did as Richard Stark.
Uh-huh.
you know, I always wanted to do something from that point of view, but I just, you know, it never, you know, the crime stuff that I've done that I'm known for is more, you know, someone stumbles into a crime, which, you know, is the fall, and ends up investigating it, and then, you know, scene of the crime, which is a mystery about a detective and a crime scene for
huge fan of Scene of the Crime.
Photographer.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, Gotham Central, which is about cops, you know, and Sleeper, where, you know, it's as much a superhero comic as it is anything else.
Well, it seems like all those things were building to Criminal, because, yeah, you kind of had all the building blocks of crime, and you're right, you focused on a hero or a good guy, or as you said, a man wrongly accused.
Yeah.
And now it's time for really looking at the criminal element in full.
Yeah, and I mean, the main characters of the stories in Criminal, like, although most of the cast members that we meet are actually good people, they just happen to be professional criminals.
Okay.
Like, that's how they're not like morally fucked people. Like,
okay.
You know? I mean, one of the first scenes for one of the main characters that we meet in issue 6, this character that we sort of build up to, one of the first things that we see him do is stop someone from raping somebody. You know, and it's like, well, yeah, he's a professional criminal. And in fact, he's been like an assassin in his life. But, you know, there's certain things that, you know, it's just because he's paid to kill somebody. He tries to only kill bad people. You know, so it's like, there's, I like those degrees of gradation. But also, I just, it's, you know, until you actually read the first issue, it's, I feel, I need to come up with a better catchphrase to try to describe it, but it's like, I really feel like we've created this full world where it just happens that all the people who are in it, who all know each other, all live on the wrong side of the law. Even those of them who are actually cops, you know, are like corrupt cops.
Sure.
You know, and it's basically like you enter this whole world. And what we're trying to do, as much as anything, you know, of course we're trying to create these riveting, action-packed crime stories. But I'm also trying to do these character studies and really sort of use the comic as much to try to create a mood as we are a plot, which I don't think, you know, is something, it's something that the right artist can do really well, and it's something I always have loved about Sean's stuff, where you can read a scene and you really feel like a mood comes across, like this darkness and this, you know, just, he's able to do that, and not a lot of artists are, and so I thought, well, that's, you know, that's something, I think if I can create that and create this world and this mood, that's as important as having, like, a good hook at the end of the issue.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like, because people will see this thing, and it's something you're not getting anywhere else.
Well, I thought you guys achieved that kind of vibe in Sleeper, because there was always this feeling that of dread, that holding no matter what was going to be fucked.
Yeah, I think we did. And this is, you know, I don't think Sleeper and Criminal will actually feel very much alike, other than that they're both, you know, drawn by Sean and written by me, and there is a fair bit of narration. I think there's less narration in Criminal than there was in Sleeper.
Okay.
But because there's more scenes of people standing around and talking. I feel like, you know, most scenes with characters talking, I want people to pay attention to the facial expressions and the dialogue and try to pick up the subtext without having me to have to hammer home what the underlying meaning of the conversation is in a narration. You know, so it's definitely going to be a book that rewards further reading, and there's, you know, we're putting layers and layers of density into the material, actually. Like, they're just background elements in visually in the pages, and, you know, there's a running thing throughout the issues that is like a meta commentary on the comic, and, you know, we're sort of going all out because we can.
That's really cool.
You know, and nobody's asking, you know, I don't have to justify why I want to do anything in like, you know, the last tier of a page and just do something there that I want to do, and, you know, I don't have to explain to an editor or anybody, like, you know, why that makes sense or why it will make sense in a few issues or anything like that. So it's really, you know, it's an interesting time. It's definitely, there's been times when I've been afraid and thinking, oh God, are we just, you know, completely going off the rails because nobody besides us is looking at any of this. And then I realized, you know, no, we're not. We've done enough comics to know.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and Sean is always my first reader on anything. So anytime, you know, I send Sean, as long as Sean, you know, keeps writing back saying that he likes what I'm giving him, then I feel like I'm on the right path.
So the first crime is a heist, and I always think that's very tough
from a tempo standpoint to put in comics form rather than seeing it, you know, develop on TV or in a film. And I wonder, from a storytelling standpoint, what kind of challenge that is to do that kind of crime.
Well, I'm working on that stuff right now, so it's a little bit more of a challenge than I thought it was. Like, I've know the heist itself backwards and forwards and how it happens, but how to address it on the page and how to make it exciting and at the same time be jumping around between that and all the characters, it is a bit of a challenge. Like, but you know, I love heist stuff so much. I've always wanted to do one.
Cool.
You know, and I just, you know, this one, you know, like if you've ever noticed, the proper heist movie generally has two heists. It has the heist at the beginning that goes wrong, and then the heist at the end where they sort of get back whoever screwed them over. And we're not exactly doing that. It's a subversion of the heist genre in a way. And someone was pointing out to me that the heist movie is sort of seen as like a bastardization of the caper film anyway. But they feel like the same thing to me, so it doesn't really matter. But the first heist usually comes in the first act of the film, and then the last two acts of any heist movie are about the fallout of the heist.
Or, sure.
You know, like the second act will end with, oh my God, we just stole all our money from the mob, you know, or something like that. So, you know, and then the third act is everyone getting killed. So, you know, I figured this out a long time ago, so I knew the nuts and bolts of how the whole story broke down. But yeah, actually constructing the heist itself has been a lot of work, and you know, hopefully we'll come across as fairly exciting because it's most of the second issue is the heist and the bloodbath that follows it.
Very cool.
So, I mean, it's along with what we're doing. One of the things that I really have wanted to do in Criminal is not just do your standard cliche crime story where you know everybody's a tough guy and everybody's totally badass and gets in fights. I wanted to do something about, you know, professional criminals who would be the kind of people who, you know, are smart enough to walk away from a fight or are smart enough to not draw attention to themselves, because any attention you draw to yourself is one more chance to go to prison.
Sure.
You know, and that's one thing I really loved about the movie Heat, which, you know, if I were in charge of, I would go back and edit out about 45 minutes of Al Pacino and then have De Niro win at the end. But otherwise, it's a great movie, and like the heists that they pull off in that are really great. But the best thing that they do is the minute that there's a chance that they might be being watched by the cops or anything like that, they just bail.
Yep.
They just drop everything and just leave. They're always willing, because you go to jail, no more scores.
Right.
You know, and you're in fucking jail. You're in the system. You want to not be in the system if you're a professional criminal. So if some asshole's giving you shit at a bar, you don't beat them to death. You don't pull out a gun and blow them away in front of 50 witnesses. You know, and so, like, one of the running elements in Criminal is this bar that they hang out in. It's a bar that used to be a speakeasy that, after Prohibition ended, just always sort of still was a criminal underground kind of bar. And it's this place. You know how some cities have those bars where you walk down from the sidewalk down into a basement bar, basically?
Sure.
You know, and
I'm in Chicago. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. In Chicago. San Francisco has one called the Cafe du Nord that I used to hang out at pretty regularly with Steve Weissman. And I always just thought, if I was living in, like, the 50s in San Francisco, this is where I would want to hang out if I'd been, like, a mobster.
Absolutely.
And so, they have this bar that's called the Undertown, but the N on the neon sign is burned out like 50 years ago and no one ever replaced it, and everyone just calls it the Undertow. and that's all the backup stories center around the Undertow, and a lot of them are narrated by the bartender, who is an ex-boxer who has one of the funniest names of anybody I've ever come up with that I just decided I'm not going to spoil.
Good. Okay, no problem.
Because it's a really good name for a character.
That's excellent.
But you know, one of the elements that runs through all the various stories in the book is, you know, this bar that most of the main characters, you know, hang out at or used to hang out at. And, you know, it's this place where they can always, you know, find out information or meet other people. And, you know, if this was a video game, it would be the place where they went to hook up with people to plan some score or something. It's just one of those places. But it's also, because of what it is, it's also, like, the safest place for most of these people to go, and you can find, like, people who hate each other sitting and playing poker in the corner, you know, and nothing ever happens because, you know, this is their place. You don't shit where you eat.
I hear you.
You know, and
it's like neutral ground.
Yeah, it's neutral ground. Yeah, it's like Sanctuary in Highlander.
Sure. I know exactly what you mean.
But and that's, you know, that was kind of the thought of it, is I wanted to have a, have something like that, and that's, you know, that's more of part of the world sort of, and but one of the things, you know, and I think that's the opposite of the sort of cliche of the crime story is. You know, I'm so sick of crime stories where everyone's like the biggest badass in the world and just kills people all the time. And I just thought, you know, that's just so unrealistic. And just the you lose the ability to have tension in your story if human life is tossed away that freely so often in crime stories. The best like crime movies are the ones where there's very little violence in them because the violence that is there is horrifying.
Sure.
You know, if you're having people's heads blown off left and right, like, it's not that big a deal. After a while, it's like a pie to the face after a while.
Sure.
And I just, you know, I wanted to really try to bring that tension back. So that was why the first story that we ended up doing is this story called The Coward, which is, you know, about Leo, who's one of the main characters of the book. And he's this really great pickpocket who's also really good at taking down scores and, you know, walking through jobs and figuring out the best way to rob a bank, or, you know, he's just got those eyes where he can see the holes in security because he sort of grew up that way. And, but he, you know, he's not a violent guy, or, you know, he doesn't want to be a violent guy. He walks away from fights all the time. He backs down over things because he wants to stay safe because his dad died in prison and he doesn't want to be like his dad, you know, and so he's got a bad rep among, you know, the general criminal element of, like, a really good criminal, but a complete pussy. And I thought, that's, you know, because, you know, I've been, in a few instances in my life, been places where I've seen a gun pulled out, and I ran like fucking the wind, you know? I could not get further away from that place. No, but, you know, that's just the way life really is. And I just thought, you know, I want this book to create an artificial life, but I don't want it to completely... I love Sin City, but I don't want to do Sin City, you know?
Sure. No, it sounds, you know, a lot of what you're describing to me sounds a lot like another Michael Mann film from the early 80s, Thief.
Oh, yeah.
Which I love.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Thief is a great movie. I prefer Thief to Heat, actually.
Me too.
Me too. Soundtrack to both could use some work.
You and Ezra Miller, you can't get away from
that. Michael Mann's dated soundtracks than Manhunter. Man, like, what a great movie that's just utterly spoiled by coming out in 1985 or 86 or whenever it is.
That's techno rock.
Yeah, the techno rock soundtrack. Just, you know, you want to yank your eyes out. It's like, you know, it's awful.
I understand.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because my mom was visiting recently, and we have a huge DVD collection, and she hasn't seen a lot of movies in the last few years because her husband was really sick, and so she was up here visiting us, and we showed her a bunch of movies she hadn't seen, and we watched Garden State.
Sure.
And I really like Garden State. I like it a tiny bit less every time I see it because I realize, you know, it's just that sort of coming-of-age kind of movie that I've seen a million times. But I like the mood of it, generally.
Okay.
And about half the soundtrack I really love, and the other half of the soundtrack are songs I actively despise. So... it's really weird because it's like half the soundtrack is like a Wes Anderson movie where you're just like, oh, I love this song.
Yep.
Oh, I love this song. And then, but the other half is like literally like music that if it comes on in like a club or a bar or something that I'm in, I will actually just leave. So I was like, I can't believe people are listening to that, you know, like whatever that song is where they do that thing that Cher did on her vocals to try to get a number one record again. You know, that weird echo chamber thing from like 5 or 6 years ago.
I know exactly what
you
mean.
That weird vocal effect that became popular for a couple years.
The filtered voice, absolutely.
Yeah, the filtered voice. And that's like at the end of Garden State, and it's just like the final nail in the coffin on like the, you know, it's like, dude, couldn't you guys have just gotten Simon and Garfunkel for the whole movie? You know, like,
hey, Peter Skarsgård and Gene Smart saved that movie for me.
Oh yeah,
they're awesome.
Yeah, Peter Skarsgård, that the scene with him and the knight, that stuff is hysterical. Yeah, his character in that movie is the best thing about it, actually.
And his
and
mom,
Natalie Portman, is just adorable all the time.
Oh, you know, honestly, she looked too Vulcan-y. Her ears were creeping me out after a while.
you got something against the Vulcans?
Well, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, but yeah, it was just like, you know, I had no idea what a Romulan the woman was. That was just kind of creepy. But
yeah, exactly.
But again, yeah, Jean Smart as the mother was just cracking me up.
Yeah, I love Jean Smart. She's a Seattle local, apparently.
Oh, that's cool.
I didn't know that, but I read an article about her when 24 was starting last year. She was the president's wife.
Uh-huh.
She was great in that, too. She's great in everything.
Oh, yeah.
I guess she was in Designing Women, which I never watched.
Well, that's the thing. That's what all the housewives know her for. And,
yeah.
And she's, like, built so many other great movies, like Mistress, that great De Niro and Robert Wool movie.
Oh, I've never seen that.
Oh, you'd like that.
Really? You,
yeah, that's a cool movie. I think you would like that. It's a cool little indie movie where, God, Martin Landau, Eli Wallach, De Niro, and Danny Aiello. And
yeah.
It's
Did you see Havoc? Speaking of, like,
I have not
people
seen
who are known by other by like housewives.
No, tell me, who's in Havoc again?
Anne Hathaway.
Oh, okay.
The Princess Diaries.
Sure,
girl.
Sure.
Like, okay, I don't have a child, so I've never seen the Princess Diaries.
Yeah, me neither.
But
she's like, hot though.
A lot of people who have kids have had to watch those movies like 100 or more times probably. And she's in this movie Havoc that it was a script that was sold like 10 years ago and never got made, about white kids trying to be ghetto-y.
Okay.
Like upper class white kids pretending to be like black or,
sure.
or like gangbanger type people.
That's pretty common. Go
and,
ahead.
Yeah, and it was a script written by somebody who I believe was like in high school or right out of high school when she actually sold the movie, and then the movie never got made. I remember it got a lot of buzz in like 1995 or 96. And then it never got made, and then what's his name? The guy who wrote Traffic and did Syriana.
Yeah, I know exactly who you mean. Not Bob Baer.
Huh?
Well, Bob Baer was based on his exploits, but he didn't write the script for Syriana.
No. The guy who was the screenwriter for Traffic and
I know.
Academy. Stephen Gagan.
Okay.
Yeah, Stephen Gagan rewrote this movie, and it was directed by somebody who was like an award-winning documentary filmmaker from the 70s and 80s, and it was her first feature film. It came out, I think it went straight to video, but it came out in the last, like, 6 months or so.
Uh-huh.
On video, and I just saw it at the store, and I'm like, Havoc, and I was reading the back of it, and I'm like, oh, this is that movie that was, like, 10 years ago, they were, you know, everybody was talking about it, and then they never made it. But Stephen Gagan rewrote it and brought it, like, up to date, basically. And I don't know, I'd love to see an earlier draft of it to see what the original one was, but Anne Hathaway stars in it as basically the star of the movie, who's this girl who is, you know, the girlfriend of this sort of, you know, wannabe, like, you know, gangbanger rich white kid. And she's running around naked and, like, masturbating and all sorts of stuff in this movie. And I just think, like, it must have been so much fun for her to, like, really screw with everyone's expectations of who she was after making all these kid-friendly, you know,
Princess Bride movies, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Or whatever.
It'd be like Gidget making porn, you know, or something like that. You know, just like, wow, okay. And it's like Jean Smart, you know, being in like these sort of more edgy roles made me think of that kind of, because it's like,
absolutely.
You know, here's somebody known for this sort of white bready kind of thing, and then they just turn around and do something that's so in your face you have to look at it.
That's really cool.
You know?
No, I'll definitely check that out. This is good. I want to know about these things.
Yeah. Oh, it's a good movie too. Actually, I kind of like it. It's not, you know, it's not the world's greatest movie, but it's definitely worth seeing. And it's got some stuff in it that I found kind of shocking. And the guy who plays Federico on 6 Feet Under is like a Mexican gangbanger. So that's kind of funny.
Very cool.
And he does seem pretty menacing.
That's cool. Now,
no one is ever as menacing as the guy in Training Day, who's also in this movie, who was the guy who was asking if he ever had his shit pushed in Training Day. Do you remember that scene?
I do.
When they're like sitting around the table with Ethan Hawke, and the guy's like, "Did you ever have your shit pushed in?" Like, that guy's terrifying. I think if I was in the same room as that guy, I would probably shit my pants.
That's awesome.
Now, here's make sure it wouldn't get pushed in.
Yee. All right, let's talk about Captain America for a second, because, dude, you hit the ground running. I mean, seriously, Winter Soldier was a great story, and, you know, I mean, God, you start off with a bang in the first issue. You off the Red Skull.
Yeah.
And shock everybody. And then
I always knew I was bringing him back.
Well, of course, and yeah,
so
you know.
Planned, there was a big clue in that scene where he gets killed. He's in one hand he's got a cell phone, and in the other hand he's got the Cosmic Cube. You know, and the Cosmic Cube isn't fully charged, which was previously established, but, you know, I figured it had just enough charge for him to attempt to take over the body of the guy he was on the cell phone with. It was very deliberately planned, and I love that nobody thought it, and that for issues when it was starting to be getting close to revealing it, that people thought that Lucan was just being driven crazy by the cosmic cube, or
sure.
that he was, when he's talking, people thought he was talking to the cosmic cube, and I'm like, no, he's talking to himself. I was so glad that nobody guessed that the Red Skull had, like, you know, tried to take over his body and failed.
Well, and that's
really happy with that.
And I think you continue to do that, Ed, because I want to talk about Daredevil later, but obviously with Foggy, you pulled the same shit with Foggy, and that was fantastic. Everyone's like, how dare you?
Thinking I'm the guy who comes in and kills everybody, but in reality, the only person I've killed is Banshee, and
thank you for
I
that.
I really kind of feel bad about that one.
Oh, I would thank you for killing Banshee myself.
He wasn't doing anything, and in fact, he'd had his throat slashed, so he could barely even scream, but it was a mercy killing.
Well, there's too many X-Men in the world for my taste, but that's
okay.
Yeah,
I would have gladly killed Gambit, but...
Well, back to Cap. Let's talk about Bucky, because I loved the fourth issue you guys did, and you had Michael Lark doing the Invaders scenes back in World War II. And you really established Bucky as this badass, and he really went from Robin to a much different character. What did you just say?
That was issue five.
Excuse me. Yeah.
Well, he was never Cap's Robin. That's the thing. If you go back and you look at those comics from the 40s,
okay.
I mean, there were some people, when the big controversy over, you know, that issue came out, where people were like, you just completely redefined Bucky. Like, all these people who loved what we did with the thing went online and they found old Captain America comics from the 40s and put up the covers. And, I mean, there's covers of Cap standing there, you know, on the battlefield, and Bucky's right next to him with a flamethrower just torching guys, you know? And it's like, Bucky was always a badass. I mean, Bucky was in World War II. Robin was running around Gotham City punching guys in little
pants.
Know, fairy boots.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I mean fairy, like, you know, pixie fairy.
I know what you mean.
Not like Devin Grayson, who I love, by the way.
And I'm a big fan of her.
I love a tiny bit more after the last week.
All right.
Because that was did you read any of that stuff online?
No.
Oh, you don't know?
No, I don't know about the dirt. I'm gonna have to read about that.
Devin wrote this book that is a she wrote a novel for one of DC's licensed novel things.
Okay.
And it's, I can't remember the name of it. It was on one of, I read it on like the Newsarama blog. They had excerpts from it.
Sure.
Apparently, she put in a lot of like humorous sort of asides because it's the whole novel is about the heroes and their sidekicks, and so she put all these humorous asides that are like these sort of little homoerotic suggestions about the sidekick, and they're hysterical.
What's the most right?
I saw it on the Newsarama blog, but apparently there's been a certain amount of furor over it, and I hope she's not in any trouble for it because it's hysterical.
That's
there's
cool.
Like a scene where it talks about Nightwing feeling Batman's hot rhythmic breath on the back of his neck. And how he remembers it from his whole life.
Nice.
Like, oh, God.
Nice.
That's hysterical, but terrifying at the same time.
I understand. It's her revenge on the Nightwing fans that were so upset
exactly.
with her.
Exactly.
Good for her.
But back to Bucky. Yeah, I always, you know, I always saw Bucky, because, you know, my experiences of as a kid with Bucky reading the Captain America comics was all the Tales to Astonish stuff that, or the Tales of, I think Tales of Suspense,
when Cap and Iron Man.
Like, the Cap and Iron Man were sharing the comic
thing,
and they did all those, like, World War II stories that Kirby and Stan Lee did, Tales of Suspense, and all the World War II ones, Bucky was always running around with a machine gun, and he always looked like he was, like, 17 or something. He never looked like that much younger than the average guy who would have been in the Army during World War II. And my stepdad lied about his age and joined the war after Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
You know, he was like 16 and he joined the Army. He was in like the Signal Corps over there. And, you know, so I knew people who, you know, and he had friends who he'd served with and stuff. So I knew these people who'd been 16 years old and fighting in World War II, 16 and 17, 18 years old, you know, people. So I always thought of Bucky as being like this 16-year-old who sort of got recruited to be, you know, this. The idea that the way he's presented to the media and the public is that he's this sort of teenager fighting side by side with Cap to counter the symbol of like the Hitler Youth. But I like the idea that there had to be more of a reason for him to be there along with like Captain America and the Invaders, because, you know, Captain America is a super soldier. Submariner is, you know, the Submariner.
Right.
The other two guys can fly and light themselves on fire. And you're like this kid who's like, you know, Captain America's Robin? I don't think so. You know, you better be able to shoot with that thing.
Well, you know, the efficient killing machine.
Yeah, so I like the idea that he's like a fully, you know, he's an incredibly well-trained soldier like any other special operative during World War II.
Well, it totally works.
Yeah, I think it really works, and I don't think it changes his history really. And we even found a way to leave in the whole him walking into the tent thing is now, like, even though it's a bit of a retcon, the idea is basically that the military, you know, in our comic we established that the guy who gave Captain America his costume also introduced him to Bucky and, you know, was in charge of Bucky being trained to be Cap's sidekick, because I just thought it was more realistic that way.
Sure.
But I didn't want to get rid of the whole Bucky walks into Cap's tent thing, so that's like the story that's released through the newsreels in the 40s, is that, you know, Bucky was just a kid who happened to stumble upon Captain America's secret identity and was turned into his, you know, sidekick, you know, so...
Yeah, that's the official story.
All of America think it could happen to them, you know, and so it's like that's how they use the symbol of it, but, you know, in reality, he's this guy that the military selected who, you know, had, like, this intense amount of training from the same people who trained Cap. He just doesn't have the super soldier serum.
Well, and yeah, you're right. Captain America was created to be a propaganda idea, and
yeah.
Then, yeah, you're just kind of... continuing
that
idea.
America used, you know, the idea of, you know, what, you know, the fake America of the Marvel Universe used Cap in a multitude of ways. He was this propaganda symbol. Whenever they, you know, take back some city during the war, you know, there'd be Cap, you know, in the parade or whatever. And, you know, whenever they have newsreel footage, you know, in the theaters, in, you know, back home, they'll have, you know, newsreel footage of Cap and Bucky on the battlefield, or footage of Cap, like, giving a speech to soldiers, or... Yeah, so Cap was used for a multitude of reasons, as well as being a super soldier, you know.
Absolutely.
So it's, you know, he's a fascinating character because of the fact that, you know, and I think that's why Bucky always fascinated me, is they have this real period of time that they're locked down to that no other superheroes have, other than, you know, any superhero who exists now that actually fought in World War II, which really is just them and the Invaders.
Yeah.
You know, everyone else is... World War II experiences. Like, Ben Grimm and Reed Richards no longer fought in World War II.
Right, right.
You know, and it was kind of unrealistic that they did, even in the 60s, but, you know, they were both seen to be guys in their late 30s when the Fantastic Four began.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and Reed maybe even in his, like, late 40s. And, you know, but it's like you can no longer say that Dr. Doom, you know, like, was in World War II running
right.
around with, you know, it's like you have to pretend that stuff doesn't exist. So it's like right now I'm actually... dealing with the fact that I have to acknowledge Peggy Carter somehow as
right.
the reason that Sharon Carter is like was obsessed with Captain America from the time she was a child, and I've just decided the only way to deal with it is to have Peggy be Sharon's mom's older sister.
Okay.
If Sharon's sister, it's Sharon's aunt. And it's like Peggy's still part of it, but because I don't want to erase Peggy Carter, but Sharon Carter's still like young and hot, and her sister can't have fought in World War II. Her sister's like 85 years old, you know? Like, that doesn't really work. But I like the idea that she's got a legacy attachment to Captain America, you know? And
absolutely.
That she's been watching old newsreel footage of him when she was a little kid, even.
Well, and I love the way, and including the current London story that you're doing, which introduces reintroduces the new Union Jack, but also
yeah.
It's great to have Spitfire there because there's that level of familiarity that the character of Spitfire brings, being part of the Invaders, knowing
yeah.
Bucky back in the 40s, and appreciating what Steve is going through with,
yeah, exactly.
You know, seeing him now as the Winter Soldier. So, yeah, good characterization, man. I think it's terrific. Are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I got an email from Bendis about some Matt Fraction article on Newsarama. This is Matt Fraction sold a restraining order on Ed Brubaker.
Well, you know, and I'm going to talk to Matt later in the week, too, because I want to talk to you guys about Iron Fist. Really looking forward to that as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think that's cool. Before I leave Cap, I wanted to ask about the Nomad fill-in issue. Was that story planned, or was that because... Art was running late, and you had to kind of come up with a fill-in story.
That was something that we came up with later. Steve Epting was going through a lot of... They had some family tragedy last year.
Ooh.
And so he got a little sidetracked for a few months, and you know, he worked through all of it, but we needed to give him a little bit of a breather, and so we had to come up with an issue, and I always felt kind of bad that I had just used Jack for like two pages and then killed him. And I thought, well, this is a chance to sort of give Jack a more proper send off, you know. And I had planned to do something like that further down the road after Bucky came back, to
okay.
have him sort of acknowledge the fact that he killed the Bucky from the 50s, you know, and,
sure.
and sort of deal with that then. And I thought, well, you know, I can deal with it now, and it'll be a neat little standalone issue for fans. And that's the thing that I really like about standalone issues, is that they give you a chance to go back in and look at something from a different angle. And that's probably from more of my sort of, you know, literary or film or even indie comic sort of background. Like, I always just love when somebody steps back into a story and shows it to you, shows you something from a different point of view, sort of.
Oh, absolutely.
I thought that stuff was really cool.
We'll pause there for part one of our conversation with Ed Brubaker. Part two coming up, lots more information about Captain America, plus a look at Ed's run on Daredevil that he took over for Brian Bendis with Michael Lark, an excellent run. And we'll talk a little bit more about Criminal and its marketing, both in the United States and abroad. That'll do it for this edition of WordBalloon.com. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to WordBalloon for updates on more upcoming episodes. And be sure to come back for part two of our conversation with Ed Brubaker. Until then, this is John Suntress. Thanks a lot for listening. WordBalloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2006.